it's basically we're an ecosystem of creatures, of different types of non-human things living in our guts. And what we eat literally feeds that. And our failure to cultivate the right, if you like, bacteria in our guts has like tremendous impact in terms of our well-being. So I say this having just eaten a chocolate croissant, by the way. So
you know, I haven't eaten anything today. I'm in my fast. So it's just black coffee so far.
Yeah, so I totally need to adopt my own sort of advice, but I definitely need to look into more fermented foods. Apparently, that's really good for you, kimchi and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I need to eat more like probiotic yogurts and, you know, Greek yogurts, those types of things. Apparently, just feeding the right bacteria and encouraging them to, you know, outcompete the ones that love sugar, for instance. So outcompete the ones that love fried foods and stuff. It reminds me very much of like environmental care will be the thing that actually creates a thriving ecosystem rather than.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think you're right. I think it's ecosystems all the way down. Mm. And so what we have to look at is, you know, you talk about the microbiome. I would also talk about the mitochondria, the sort of the powerhouse of the cells, which is not actually your DNA. Yep. And if they're not being looked after, and if they're not being properly fed. That's predictive of being very, very ill.
You know, we should also talk about sounds at some point. As a couple of friends of mine are really into audio, and their theory is, look, it very clearly through different pitches, it impacts things, and you can see it very visibly in a liquid state. So in other words, there's a sound, liquid moves. Of course, human beings are bags of water, you know, cellularly. We are predominantly liquid. So the sound experience or the sound environment that we have also has a significant impact on things like well-being. So I wonder, go on.
Well, I'm just hoping we don't get the Hong Kong Symphony while in the middle of this, because we should be just drills going off everywhere.
I was going to say, you're in a super noisy environment. Hong Kong's always been construction heavy. I'm actually in a Manly right now in North Sydney. Oh, nice. And it's very quiet, obviously, because it's kind of beachfronty type of place. But yeah, I can already feel...
It's a bit more noisy at 7 o'clock at night, from my experience.
Yeah, we're going out later and it'll be craziness. But yeah. Right now we're in a super quiet place. It's very
I lived in the Lower North Shore for 11 years, so Manly really? was a boat ride away from me, or a quick car drive, so I know it well. Yeah,
you know it's a paradise on earth. We're live, everybody, so welcome to Brain Food Live on Air, bringing it to you every Friday. We missed last Friday because basically I was too tired and hungover and jet lagged to do it. But we're back on. I'm on Aussie time today and will be for next week as well. And we're going to do a special on both occasions, focusing on different topics we usually don't cover. So quick word first to our sponsors. This episode is sponsored by our friends at Daxtra. Daxtra are, of course, a software business that basically improves data. If you're a business that's literally, you know, clogged up with hundreds of thousands of records that no one's looking at, no one's using, you need those things refreshed and updated. You can't do it any other way other than using a product like Daxtra, which is going to help basically refresh that data for you, activate it from being from a dormant state. They've been around for a long time, multinational company. If you're a possessor of any kind of data you need to update, check out Daxtra. It's daxtra.com. Okay, so let's get on with the show. We have a special today, and the reason why I want to isolate Dr. Richard Claydon for a one-to-one, because I remember the last time we had a chat, I involved you in a traditional panel style thing, and you basically said 90% of the most interesting things, but you only had like 10% of the time. So I thought, no more of that. Let's go one-on-one. Let's talk to this guy. By the way, I'll have you introduce yourself in a second, but I do recommend everyone who's watching this follow Richard's LinkedIn, or at least connect with Richard on LinkedIn, because I think he is by far and away the most like intelligent commentator and poster on LinkedIn. And I include myself in my postings. I think I'm pretty good. But Richard is a step above. I think he's mastered the art of writing these short form essays that basically provide so much insight, so much innovation, but also then lead on to further conversations you can have. I think it's a wonderful account to follow for that reason. Anyway, Richard, enough sort of eulogizing for your good self. Quickly introduce yourself. Who are you? What it is you do?
Yeah, it's always a difficult question. What I actually do, because it's on the margins, so it's quite difficult to explain. But let's go for the easy stuff first. Is I teach on MBA programs. I teach leadership and organizational behavior. They're the two ones that I generally get. Sometimes a bit of change and stuff like that, and consult and advise and do workshops in organizations on the same. And I'm. As we'll be talking about leadership, so we'll go into my quite relatively unique perspective on leadership as we go in. But the other thing that I do is we're working on the concept of extended intelligence and extended intelligence networks, and then how do you use extended intelligence networks to develop and train people and to improve organizational performance. So that's kind of the stuff at the margins. But what we're really looking at is there are three levels of kind of performance in an organization. There's individual productivity, which is, you know, how quickly do you produce a specific pieces of work that you're paid for. There's collective performance, which is kind of the collaborative stuff. And then there's that growth and development at both individual and organizational level, and which requires you to bring in all kinds of different ideas from different perspectives. So it's very transdisciplinary. And what we try and do is do that kind of transdisciplinary learning in organizations to rapidly accelerate the overall knowledge base of the organizations. It becomes more innovative because you bring in, suddenly you've got these different domains clashing and you can be creative because, oh wow, look, that domain, looking at this from that domain angle, and we can do the go and do this. So we try to do that in that kind of adaptive agility innovation space. I have a number of clients that we're beginning to scale it with as well, because we think we can scale it at like mass levels. So we would have, it's a bit like if you think of it as a gym. So if you're very wealthy or a senior executive in an organization, you get yourself a personal trainer to train you. And so we can train high level executives in this kind of way of developing with a very personal touch. We can, if you're sort of a little bit below that, you want to do a spin class, you know, you're paying a bit more money and you want to do a spin class, and you're maybe it's a group of 20 or 30, and again, you've still got a live instructor. But then when we already know we can do it, it's just rolling it out into organizations that believe it's possible. Mm-hmm. You can, it's the same as watching a YouTube video, going and then going to the gym to do what you've learned on the YouTube video. And we can teach pretty much any subject with this self-managed structure. But it's not just you sit and listen to someone for an hour. You break up the active and passive content. So you listen to it and then you respond to it. So you mentioned my LinkedIn posts. Mm. You know, it's the same as that. You give the initial information. And then the most interesting thing about my LinkedIn posts is not what I'm saying. It's the discussion that happens underneath the LinkedIn post when you've got 15 different people with 15 different perspectives. It's how do you create that at scale across the organization and start tracking it and start mapping it and start using it. And that's where we're going at the moment with the technology and the methodologies we use.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I think that, I mean, from a marketing point of view, I call that stuff conversational marketing, right? Where essentially it's not the content of a single author that's most interesting, but it's actually the dialogue that's interesting. And it's the whole piece at the end that you can absorb and crunch through. Because oftentimes the person who's instigated the conversation, the primary value is the instigation rather than a knowledge share. I see my value, I'm not an expert like you. So I see my primary value is creating the conversational spaces and then starting a conversation and then just have smarter people talk through it.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. We step away. You get even the experts will step away. You know, someone can be really expert in it. And when some of the things we've done, we brought in someone who's sort of a serious thinker in this space, and they tell us how much they've learned from being involved in the conversations as well.
Right.
And it's that mutual learning that's part of it.
And what's exciting about this is that it does kind of break the barrier down from the kind of elite expert person and then the kind of, the masses that are meant to absorb the information. The traditional educational structure has always been that way, where, you know, you've got the impoverished kind of masses, you know, they're taking a little bit of that knowledge, you know, from these people have got excess knowledge. But in fact, no, it's the collaboration from which we all share that information. and the different perspectives will help you as a group all go forward from it. So I do think companies struggle with this because it's companies, generally speaking, are hierarchically structured. And the orders flow down, from a structure. Information flows down from a structure. It's often very siloed. So let's start with that sort of concept to begin with, Richard. How does a company that has traditionally been hierarchical start breaking this hierarchy up in a non-destructive manner or in a non-damaging manner so that it's still a cohesive company? You start opening up these opportunities for collaborative information generation, so to speak.
Well, I think it's sort of already happening. So, I mean, if you look at the agile movement, and there are good and bad things to say about the agile movement, but the basic idea, if you're talking about organizational agility, you're talking about a flattening of the organizational hierarchy. And you can look back into almost organizational history. You could argue that there's been an ongoing flattening of the hierarchy over the last 100-120 years. Its initial acceleration was the Japanization of organizations, when strong organizational culture came into the milieu and out of Japan, that was sort of introduced late 70s, early 80s. That was a big flattening, and we're now seeing agility as another flattening of it when we're looking at software agility and agile teams, etc. The challenge organizations have is these embedded payment structures where you've got a number of payment structures going up through and you're supposed to be managing the team underneath you. This talks a lot to the kind of work we do. Historically, in leadership terms, if you were the person and you had sort of 20 people below you, the reason you were above them is because you could do their job better than them. And you were initially directing them if they were new, and then you were supporting and coaching them as they got better. And then ultimately you were delegating the work to them because they'd grown up through the system. Now we've got multifunctional teams left, right, and center. There's no way that a manager can actually understand all the work that's being done. So having the technical skills, whereas historically really important, is not actually key anymore. What you need to do in the contemporary organizations is you need to have, for me, it's a sort of a deep, broad and wide understanding of human behavior in complex adaptive systems. So we would look at how do you restructure around that knowledge. And then you've got companies like Hire in China who are already doing it. So the images always look like circles sitting next to each other, these little units of agile teams, and them all being sort of semi-dependent, but then having supportive groups elsewhere. And so it looks like a network of circles. So it's already happening. The challenge is we've got this bunch of middle managers and senior leaders, actually, who haven't been given the developmental work to understand what it means for humans to be in these complex conditions. And that's the kind of work we try and do, is to give them an understanding of that.
I would even go so far as to say that there is vested interest in the people who have succeeded in the old way of working, that will kind of be a very conservative force to innovation of this type. So even though they may, in other words, there'll be resistance to this change, because if the person has succeeded in some way in the old way of working, they may look at any new change as a threat to that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are definitely vested interests in, and absolutely understandable. You sort of say, I've
totally logical. Yeah.
Very hard to get to this position where I've now got 40 people reporting to me. Why would I give it up to have it flattened and not have as many reports? Because there's power structures and status going on within the system.
And status competition is super important. I always put a black mark against anybody who refers to my team. when they're very use possessive language when they're talking about people who they're managing or their business and so on. And I totally get it that, it's not a factually inaccuracy to say this. But if it's kind of overemphasized, I get the feeling that it's really, really important for that person to have their team.
Well, it's interesting because I know your main audience is recruiting. And so I put a black mark against anybody when I'm interviewing them or talking to them and they say, I did this. Because in interdependent work, there's no way you did that. there was a collaboration with a group of people that enabled that to happen. Yeah. And you might have played you might have played an important role in that collaboration, but if you're just saying, no, this was me. And I know quite often within in recruitment, they go the opposite way. They say, no, I don't want to know who we are. I want to know what you did. And I'm the exact opposite. I want to know what the we did and what your contribution to the collective performance was in order for me to start working with you.
Here is where recruiting gets in its own way, because we are very keen to try and identify the you contribution. And so, in fact, we're trained to try and isolate. We would penalize someone who used the we context. And in fact, people are coached to say use possessive language, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a bit of a fantasy, as you say, because in a complex job and a job which involves a lot of collaboration, it's impossible to isolate your contribution. We can't test it for a start. You know, we can't replay time and take you out and see what happens. All we can say with any kind of confidence is that you were present in this team, your function was this, and you contributed to this outcome in some way. And the attribution is kind of always going to be ambiguous, or at least not directly evident. So I think recruiters do get in their own way a little bit. Leadership, let's look at some of the contemporary sort of controversies, if you like, that are occurring in the world of recruiting in HR. And I want to get your take on it, because I've got my take and, you know, I bore myself with my take, but let's hear yours. We always talk about leadership now. There's a lot of progressive values associated with leadership. So things like transparency in salary, for instance, big topic everywhere. You see sort of legislation in the US, state by state, it seems to say, you know what, we're going to go transparency with salary. It's probably identified now as a sign of kind of cultural leadership for a business to say, yeah, we're salary transparent. However, there's associated problems with going that route. What are your thoughts on something like this? How does a leader behave when there is kind of it's not obvious that this is the right thing to do, even though there's a big kind of PR push, if you like, that's associated with this. Does a good leader kind of resist the popular? Is a good leader an anti-populist, or is a good leader simply surfing the populist wave?
I mean, the big challenge I have with the salary stuff is that organizations aren't paying for the value of the job. They're trying to work out what the value of the person is. And so, you know, can I get this person for $5,000 less than, you know, the job should be worth something. Okay. And that's what you pay. Right? And that for me is where transparency might work is right. The job is worth something. I'm not going to try and screw anyone by trying to negotiate a lower salary or something. The job is sort of worth something. And but the interesting thing with that is when you get to the senior leadership roles where they're being paid, you know, ridiculous amounts of money. And is their job worth that? If you look at the evidence, no, it isn't. I mean, there's no evidence that a sort of a CEO is creating that much extra, the kind of extra value that they're taking home. I mean, they're riding the wave of the market very often, and they go, oh, look, I've done really. Or if they're unlucky, the market crashes and they don't do very well. So you've got all kinds of, again, power and status and politics bedded in the decision to make stuff transparent. But you understand why they're potentially doing it, because there is evidence that certain genders or even like fat people get paid less than thin people for the same job, which is just ultimate discrimination. So men tend to get paid more than women, and someone prettier gets paid more than someone who isn't as naturally attractive. So you've got all kinds of biases going on. So I can see why people wanted to be transparent to get rid of the biases. But I don't think necessarily that biases are a great thing to get rid of to do good work. I actually think biases are very valuable when you're doing good work, and you need to have a collection of biases to create multiple perspectives, rather than everybody's now thinking and behaving the same way and because we've got rid of everyone's bias. So there's some really interesting intellectual challenges going on.
That's really interesting. You're the first person I've heard say this, where it kind of in defense of biases. And I do say this myself, because I do think that it's kind of a futile exercise to try and mitigate against it. I think a lot of it is performative, where we're saying, yeah, we've de-biased this. And I'm saying, have you really, at the end of the day, who is making the, unless you remove the human being entirely from a hiring decision, then I think you've injected something in there that is inevitably non-objective. It's almost like a, you know, it's the impossibility of observing anything without being a participant in that exercise. Like, you are contributing to whatever you've observed. We know this at the level of physics. So it is one of these to say, you know, if we do get to a world where every bias is we attempt to remove everything, what we might end up doing is actually homogenizing culture to a point whereby it can only ever be this. And it becomes a very, not even gray, but potentially even a dehumanizing kind of situation.
Yeah. So the way I look at it in bias is it's inevitable. And I mean, you and I are experiencing this differently because we're in different environments, etc. So if we then report about what our experience was, your reporting will be different than mine. That will be biased based on where you're sitting and your immediate environment, as will mine. And we can't avoid this. So when we every experience we have will be biased by our own subjective existence. To try and eliminate the imperfect biased elements of humanity, isn't it lovely if we could all treat everybody absolutely perfect? I'm not that interested in. I think it's terrible to treat somebody differently because of their gender preferences or their race or their age or anything like that. What I'm interested in is the concept of bounded rationality and bias. That what you want is teams that interpret the world differently. So this is going back to the question about agile and getting rid of the hierarchies. If you've got 10 small agile teams, let's say 3 or 4 people per team, and you're sending them off to do some innovative exploratory work, what you want is them not to talk to each other.
Mm.
You want them to go off and explore according to these 4 people per team. And what you're going to have is 10 different ideas coming from these little exploratory teams, because their experience of the problem is going to be bounded by the 4 of them experiencing it together and having their own personal biases coming in and interpreting it through those lens. So once you've got your 10 possible solutions, you accept that not all of them work. Not all of them are going to work. So so let's say we've got 2 that are going to be potentially quite good, 2 that might be back burner, and then 6 that are rubbish.
Yep.
But that's fine. Once you go one of the teams that came up with the rubbish idea, you quickly find out that one's not working, but one of the other ideas is working. When you merge those 2 teams together, you give them the resources of the team. You don't punish them for saying you came up with a bad idea. You go, bad luck, your idea is, but these guys seem to be doing something, so you go off and help them.
Yeah,
and that's what I want to create in organizations.
And also, I think the language needs to be important there to avoid the sense of judgment. So you don't say good or bad idea. Maybe it's more about context appropriate. The thing that you're heading toward is the 11th context, right? So you have 10 contexts of these a bounded rationality, so to speak. The thing that you're going towards is the 11th thing that is closest to, and then you just pick the one that is, most appropriate for that. It doesn't mean that the ones you haven't chosen isn't right. It's just not right for this moment and not right for that context.
Oh yeah, it's not bad per se. It's just, it's an experiment you've created that doesn't happen to be working at the moment, but it's worth having in the data bank for future situations.
Do you know what? This kind of thing needs to be engineered in some way. And I'm pleased that you're putting work into it to try and kind of systematize this approach, because there's obvious experiments are generally good. We know this. And we also know that that kind of sense of oscillation where you have dispersion of teams that are exploring and then you integrate them together to share the information and then go ahead to one. That reminds me very much how empires work. In history and also in contemporary times, I guess, different civilizations will have and create different solutions to similar problems, and they're very different. And this is why, you have certain cultures invent the wheel and certain cultures did not invent the wheel, but they'll invent something else that helps them move things along at a quicker rate. And what happens is those things would much better to be independently evolved, those experiments. We bring them together, hopefully not in a critical and an abusive manner like the empires were, but we bring them together in a controlled way so that we can exchange the information, see which one worked best for this future, and then we move forward again. And I don't think you can do that in within culture. You almost need to have separate experiments, as you say, that don't talk to each other for a certain period of time, that can kind of create a version of the future that you can then compare. You know, which is, you know, it's an interesting thing to think about. Like,
I'm tending to I mean, it's interesting you use the word culture, because I'm tending to get rid of the word culture when I'm talking about organizations now, because I mean, I think it's becoming increasingly clear that what organizational cultures say on the tin are not what anyone experiences. So I look at, and I think it's an almost useless term now. I look at the notion of networks, behavioral environment. And that's what we're trying to create in organizations. And that's what we're both talking about. We're saying, right, we've got this network behavioral environment where people are going off and doing their interpretive work. And every now and again, you've got the core, and you bring everyone back into the core, and you let the ideas sort of clash and be creative, and domains hitting each other. And then out of that comes a whole bunch of new ways of doing stuff. And that rather, and all of these biased interpretations or bounded rationalities are absolutely vital to doing this work well. And you've Correct. Talked about ecosystems. That's what happens in an ecosystem. The bits at the edges start adapting to their experiences in the locations they're at.
Yep.
And if you're just saying, no bias, bring everyone together, you don't get the adaptive behaviors. And if you don't get the adaptive behaviors, you risk extinction.
Yep, I think that's right, because what you're doing is homogenizing. And when you create homogenized sort of ways of doing, it becomes brittle. Because if everyone is behaving in the same way, how do we react when there's an unprecedented scenario or we encounter something that's really weird and not got any experience in? It's much better to have a diverse set of responses to that rather than have a single set of responses with everyone's automatically going to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. So one of the things, I mean, don't want to get into politics in the course of this talk, but one of the things that I think is quite interesting is, I'm very happy that the Catholic mission of trying to make everyone a Christian failed, because I think that's actually a good thing that we have different people, you know, with different ideological positions and different worldviews and so forth. Not to say one is more right than the other, but at least there's diversity in there, ideological diversity, which will help us solve future problems, even though, you know, at the middle range of the period, it may result in adversarial sort of contact. I think what we've got to do, ideally as a species, is to manage that adversarial encounters so that they don't become wholly destructive. I think it is possible for us to have different ideologies, different systems, different cultures, different ways of behaving, different networks of behaving, for instance, and together as a species, that's going to help us. You know, I always think what's going to happen if we encounter an alien species, Richard, and I think we'd be better off if we had like multiple ways of solving that problem.
I think you don't have to talk about this in terms of politics. You can talk about it in terms of any organization. I mean, you guys recruit people. And you know, you're recruiting an accountant versus someone in the marketing. They're going to have a very different perspective on the world. Mm. You know, and the notion of saying, right, we're going to have to connect, we're going to have to homogenize them by getting them to into this culture where there's shared values and shared behaviors and things. It's just like, doesn't make any sense. The fact that they've got different interpretations of the world and they're seeing problems from very, very different perspectives is not a weakness, it's a strength. It's just about how to, you know, and again, you said that instead of having the ideological clashes where it's a war, you have the ideological clashes where it's a celebration. It's like breaking bread together while discussing things together. I mean, your thing is brain food. It's about breaking bread together. You know, it's sharing interesting information as food or over food. And that's the key.
So there's two things to create this non-adversarial way of exchanging information. Number one, maybe we have to find a way to agree to disagree, right? So as you mentioned with the different teams, there was kind of an agreement between them all that actually we're going to decide at one point what we're going to do, and everyone agrees on that decision. So we kind of agree. What's the Amazon sort of term? It's like disagree and commit or something, where at the end of the day, we agree there's a process where we disagree, and then we just commit to it anyway because we're a team. So there's that thing to do. And then another way to do it, maybe it is breaking of bread. There might be some sort of ritual That is not related to the project per se, but you all perform the ritual in order to identify very clearly that we're in the same kind of boat. And from there, that's how we disseminate. We get to
I think it's an important word, because when you talk about rituals and you can talk about myths and ceremonies and organizational heroes, this was the language we were using to describe organizations 40 years ago. You know, the birth of the culture movement, it was all about ritual and ceremony and all of this rites and all of this kind of really powerful language. Now it's been scientized. We talk about fit and compliance and ads and stuff like that. It's like, what are you guys doing when you're doing this work? Why have we lost all of this richness of how things actually work? And you're going into a psychometric thing to see if someone's values or personality or type fits with what you want in the organization. It doesn't make any sense. Yet that's where all the money is.
Well, hang on. Isn't that simply the art and science debate, where science has always had the whip hand to a large degree because, firstly, it's closer to the money, and money itself could be considered a form of science when you think about it. It's like a quantification of it. So perhaps the things that are more easily quantified kind of end up aligning together, and the things that are a little bit more amorphous and difficult to collect have always, you know, been kind of on a losing hand a little bit, you know, when the two argue and debate. However, I will say that I'm a believer that it is possible to quantify certain parts of culture, particularly when you do analyze behaviors of people. Like you say, you don't listen to the self-reported version of how things were, but you can observe the behavior, and from there you can find something out. Like, for instance, LinkedIn came out with a very crude list of top 50 companies, right? Now, I'm sure the same as you, very critical of any listing of systems of companies in this way. They're always the same characters at the top, et cetera, et cetera. We get it. However, what was interesting in this little bit of research was that they tried to do it in a quantified way by saying, oh, we can sort of say something about tenure. So we can sort of have this huge bit of, not a survey, but they've got the data. This is LinkedIn. So they can actually think, right, it seems that a person in this job at this level in this company spends, you know, 20% of time longer than a similar person in a similar job in a competitor company. You can probably infer something from that information, particularly if it's year on year. You can start saying, you know what, for some reason, people are happier to stay longer. Maybe it's better pay, maybe it's better incentives, maybe better something. So I think it is possible to quantify, but it's still very niche. It's called an organizational network analysis, right?
We do some of that, yeah. So for me, you've got to look at, you really need to look at the lens through the two perspectives. If you look at the sociological analysis, because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about the sociological analysis of organizations. And you've got two different perspectives. You've got one, what you're talking about, which would be the social physics. Okay, I can do the social networks, I can see who's talking to who, I can look at all the data around who's staying how long, and et cetera, et cetera. And that's a really useful set of information. But then you've got the linguistic interpretation of sociological studies, which is, right, well, listen, we've got to listen to the stories. And you've got to do both. And that's so currently the technologies are there to do the social network and the organizational network analysis. They are beginning to get sophisticated enough to do the narrative analysis. So I think what you're going to find, and we already work with narrative analytics, you're going to find that you're going to capture all of the organizational stories. So quantify the qualitative, basically. So you're going to have hundreds and hundreds of organizational stories. And you're going to have this second level of data, which is the more social physics network analysis. And you're going to put them together. And that's where the value is going to be created, because you're going to understand what people are saying and thinking and behaving at all kinds of levels. So the challenge at the moment for me is to get organizations to invest in this kind of narrative analytics work, but it's coming soon.
How do they do a narrative analysis? Is this ethnography? Is this simple interviewing?
It's ethnography at scale, because the technologies are available now. So you can, you could just go in and do an ethnography as a social scientist and you know, do it all by yourself in the old school way. Or you can do micro narratives at scale.
Can you explain exactly what does that mean?
So, the micro narrative is literally, right, you're experiencing something, mm-hmm. and you've got an open-ended. So the three questions we use in learning, because we use micro narratives in learning, so when you just learn something, you'll get the option to answer one, two, or three questions. It's up to you whether you're choosing to answer them. And the first one was what was confirmed and reinforced. So basically, what did you already know that's now been doubled down on? The second question is what was new and challenging. So what have you sort of not understood before, etc. And the third one is what questions do you now have? What was unclear? And so each of these you can write as much as you like to say, well, okay, I this was confirmed, reinforced, and I understood this, and this was new, and this was, and you know, it could be 10 words, it could be 200 words, it could be 1,000 words. It's totally up to you how much you fill in. And then you push it into the technology or the database, etc., and it clusters all of the stories. So you'll find out that there's a whole bunch of people who want to know more about this. Okay, and you go, well, okay, this is obviously important for part of the organization, and there's not enough learning around that, so let's design a course around what they all want to know, and et cetera, et cetera. You find out that the major perspectives of the of this subject matter are this, this, and this, and you can then identify, well, yeah, maybe we don't actually want everyone thinking about it this way. That might not be the best way, so we need to start. And then where some of the challenging direct. So you get a bunch of stories that all get clustered together about what everybody is thinking and experiencing around just the learning environment. In this case, it doesn't have to be learning environment, it can be anything. Once you've got the landscape of stories, the very simple thing to say is, well, how do we get fewer stories like that, and how do we get more stories like that? And some of the work we've done is you do current conditions, so bad current, good current, and then you have hopes and fears for the future, so bad future, good future. And so you're trying to map it, all of the interventions you do, you're trying to map it to get people towards the good future. But what you're doing is you're getting the lived experience of the organization the people at scale. And you're saying, right, and it's a very simple question. How do we prevent these kind of terrible stories, fewer stories like that? How do we create more stories like this? And so to help them move into a direction where, and then you can genuinely say, this is a great working environment, because all of the stories people are telling are amazing stories.
Yep, and you can even kind of have a look at the sense of progress, maybe, like, for instance, there's dynamism in this collection, so you can start seeing things moving forward. Leadership, what role do leaders have in moving this forward? are they designing this and setting back? Are they leading from the front in some way? Like what does leadership look like at the various levels of leadership? You know, there's loads of different leaders in different tiers.
It's quite an interesting question. So generally, leadership is in a horrendous state at the moment. I mean, you look at the global stats around leadership development and people leaving organizations because they get no development, or the manager treats them terribly. And so we just take that almost as read at the moment, that the leadership development and the leadership field is in a bad state and needs a mass level of reimagination. Now, I see leadership as historically having occurred in 360-year chunks. So 1840 to 1900, great man theory and all the related progressive models, the arguments they had then. You then had scientific management and from 1900 to 1960, and we're now 1960 to 2020, we're at the end of the humanistic phase, where you're talking about transformational leaders and authentic leaders. It's hit its sell by date. It's no good anymore, which is why the stats are so bad. And we're having to reimagine what leadership looks like. So we're going into, and we've talked ecosystems already. One of the theories is we need to understand leadership in an ecosystemic lens. We need to understand leadership as enabling adaptability, as connecting these various different ways of behaving together, as being the connective core of the organization rather than the decision makers at the top. And so one part of the work we try to do is say, well, okay, you're trying to create collective sense making. you're trying to collect, to do rapid decision making and rapid action taken based on this collective sense making where everybody's brain comes together because nobody's as, none of us are as smart as all of us. So how do we create those kind of conditions? How do you develop leaders who can do this? And what we find is that, most traditional leaders, and the reason leadership stats are so bad, is they act as blockers. So they block the collective sense making. They say, no, I'm the subject matter expert. It's my opinion that matters. They block the decision making because they say, well, I'm the manager. It's my decision to make. And they block the action taken by limiting resources and controlling stuff. So that they're actually, and this is not the fault of the person. This is the development system that currently exists. So they're locked into an understanding of leadership that's no longer fit for purpose. So you're trying to move them away out of that blocking space. And then you're really looking at perhaps, I mean, what I try and do is you go back into the last, the 180 years we thought about leadership, and you pull out all of the stuff around systems performance in the last 180 years. So there's a huge amount around an ecosystemic understanding of leadership. And guess what? When you probe it all, well, they're all organizations that have flourished and become market dominant, et cetera, et cetera. And then you try and train the contemporary leaders. And we have some clients where we're doing this, and it's incredibly powerful. But you try and train them to lead in a complex adaptive system, to lead in an ecosystem. And that requires an understanding, a very different understanding of self, a very different understanding of systems. You're going into that gestalt, understand self, understand system, and toggling between the two, understanding your role, understanding the different ways you need to play your role. It's fascinating work, but there's a lot to be done because it's generally not taught that way.
Wouldn't it be fair to say, because listening to what you said, saying there about how the relationship of our understanding of leaders will change, but a leader's relationship with an ecosystemic lens is less leadership-like than our traditional understanding of it. In other words, it almost seems as if the leader is less of a decision maker, less of a decider, an instructor and delegator, but more of a cultivator. So, I see this, we're using biological metaphors here. So I see this person like as a gardener. They're literally planting seeds and they're watering garden, they're pulling sort of weeds out, they're doing those things, but they're not determining, they're influencing at a higher level. But is there a case to be made that this person is no longer a leader? Like the word itself is no longer suitable to describe what this person does.
A leader is someone who makes people want to follow them. So we've got the difference between in a position, what we would call a leadership position, which is potentially a position, just a position of authority. Okay, I have power over you because I'm higher up than you in a hierarchy. Okay, but we tend to call these people leaders. Mm-hmm. But they're not. They're just people with a position of authority, and they can make you do the work you want to do. So maybe some people would say, well, that's the leadership-management divide, and they're actually managers, etc. And the leader is the person who makes me want to do the work, and I feel the purpose and the passion by following them. And that's where you've got kind of the Silicon Valley kind of, Steve Jobs would have been the exemplar of that kind of figure. But this is just a revisiting of heroic leadership, great man theory back from the 1840s, and it's problematic. So the way we look at it is the leadership is the capacity of the community to create its own future. So it becomes multidimensional and collective. So rather than just, and you still have to have somebody who is the ultimate decision maker, but they're embedded in a community. And actually, they need to be as good a follower as they are a leader, because they hand over the leadership mantle to somebody else when it's not their area of expertise and they're no longer. So it becomes this kind of fluid passing of the leadership mantle within a team. So you need to be just as good a follower as you are a leader. You need to be able to play both roles. And then the styles we look at, you say, well, the three styles when you're working in these complex adaptive spaces, you need to be adaptive. You need to have the leadership adaptive. Ability or adaptive style. You need to have the participative style, which is this, I'm just one member of a group, and you need to have the innovative style. So the adaptive style is basically trying to get people who are employed because of their expertise to get involved in complex systems where expertise is not actually required, because you have to explore and you don't know what the cause and effects are, and you have to do all of that work. So that's the adaptive style. How do you get experts to throw off the mantle of expertise and get involved in exploration? The participative style is, how do you run and facilitate the exploration once they're there, to make sure everybody's voice gets heard, psychological safety, does everybody's voice get heard? Do we make sure all the ideas are actually on the table rather than somebody sitting in the corner with the best idea in their head, but they won't say anything because power and status gets in the way? And then you have the innovative style, which is, how do we keep as many possible avenues into the future open as we can when we make this decision? And if you put those three together, how do we stop the expertise getting in the way? How do we make sure everybody's voice is heard? And then how do we keep as many possible future pathways open as we can when we make this decision? Then you've got something really interesting. And so that's really what we're trying to teach contemporary leaders to do, is those three things. And throw off all of this stuff around authority and I'm in charge and you just do what I do. And depending on who we work with, so we've got, there would be two different interpretations. One would be only about 10% of leaders behave this way, which has been the position for maybe 30, 40 years when in this kind of way of thinking. And the other, but there are some people who are far more optimistic and say, no, it's about a quarter of leaders now who are beginning to behave this way and we're moving in the right direction. But that's the kind of work that we try and do.
Wouldn't you say that incentive alignment, disalignment is the biggest challenge here? Because we're going to, like, the reason why leaders would behave, I would say, in a traditionally authoritarian way, you know, the invocation of authority and stuff like this, is because their alignment with the company values is separated somewhere down the line. And in fact, it makes more sense for them at a local level to behave in this way because it's better for them at a personal level. So we've all been in businesses where there's turf wars, there's territorialism, there's you know, clearly people are operating without thinking of the greater good, but thinking instead of their particular team or even within, you know, even within a very close circle themselves. So how do we align the incentives, I guess, so that it encourages everyone to try and do this type of stuff?
The best model I've ever seen was the Scandinavian model. And the we would call it the Scandinavian model of management in the literature. And sadly, actually, this has been a little bit damaged by Agile. But the Scandinavian model, and I worked in Denmark for about 7 years, so I was very au fait with it, is you don't just have vertical promotions. So you promote horizontally as well. So just because you're managing somebody else doesn't mean you're being paid more than them. Because you're being pushed vertically because of your ability to do this kind of work I've just talked about, you know, the adaptive and innovative and participative work. That's why you get promoted vertically. You're able to keep the teams together and to do that work. If you're being promoted horizontally, it's because you're a subject matter expert and highly technical and doing. But if putting you in charge of people would be an absolute nightmare. Right? So that's the model, that's the Scandinavian model. You know, Scandinavia is routinely held up as having the highest standards of living, the greatest level of happiness, one of the highest levels of innovation in the work that they do. And so you're sort of looking at, well, how do we recreate this model elsewhere where the culture, the cultural norms are different? So you could still, you could look at an organization. I think you can look at any organization on the planet and you'll see a whole bunch of people who are highly skilled technically up through the system. And you said, like, you still keep your salary. You still, and we really want you to run the technical elements of your job, but you're not in charge of people anymore. You're part of the team as the technical expert, and somebody else is going to be given that role to and it doesn't mean they're going to, whilst you're in theory reporting to them, it doesn't mean they're getting more money than you. It doesn't mean that they're being held and, you know, that your work is less important. But there's that massive cultural shift between what happens in Scandinavia and what the rest of the world does.
Yeah, and perhaps we kind of, I hate to use the word naturally, because I don't know whether it's naturally, but I kind of have some sympathy with the view that we might kind of inherently align to a hierarchical way of being, because it seems to be that
you're going down a rabbit hole here.
I am, but I'm just simply theorizing that perhaps a basic hierarchy may be the simplest way to organize a group of people. So it might be the earliest kernel of how human beings started organizing.
So let's look at this in terms of evolutionary time frames. So if you look at so this notion of hierarchy being the natural state of being.
Okay. I do put air quotes.
It's an important argument. So you know, and the classic one was Jordan Peterson's lobsters. Okay, that was the one that was. But he had lobster hierarchies, and they have the oldest code that you know, the oldest code that we know of, and we've all sort of accelerated. Yeah. So if our great 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 ancestors at the level of sea animals with shells had this natural hierarchy, then therefore we do too, and you can see it in it. Right. So that's the argument. The other argument is, well, okay, that's the case. But at the same time, you've got these complex adaptions going on. So when you look at lobster hierarchies or human hierarchies, you look at it in terms of a time frame that is quite finite. And you sort of, what actually has happened over thousands and thousands of years, if you've had all kinds of different social systems that have integrated and changed, and some have been more complex adaptive with less hierarchy, and some have been more hierarchical, and even looking at the world today, you've got all of these different models and that they're all working. What we're looking at now is the sheer speed of work. Okay, that everything's speeding up, it's digital worlds, etc., etc. In the digital sped up world, this kind of hierarchical model doesn't make any sense anymore. Because it doesn't actually make sense if you look at the world as a whole over many, many, many thousands, millions of years. It's not hierarchical, because even the lobsters, the big lobster dies or gets beaten and the hierarchy changes. So over thousands and thousands or millions and millions of years, it's a complex adaptive system with different parts fitting and moving around each other. What we're doing in work now is it's so fast moving. It's so quantum, we've talked a little bit about quantum, it's so quantum and fast moving, we have to throw off the hierarchy and recognize that the complex adaptive system and the ecosystems, et cetera, are reality. And we're going to be, it's going to be advantageous to us to construct our systems like that now. But it's about understanding time frames, and so if you're looking at evolutionary time frames, you can see the complex adaptive patterns, but you're looking at millions of years. Now we can see the complex adaptive patterns within days of the work happening, and so you're looking at, okay, it's just about the acceleration of time that we're talking.
It's very interesting, because you're talking about the kind of dynamic between internal organization and the external environment. And the conditions of the external, what you're saying is that the conditions of the external environment are so dynamic that your internal organization needs to recognize that as the first thing, because if you're kind of soldiering on with a rigid a non-adaptive system, it will quickly come a cropper, because it simply does not mesh with the world that it is.
You're going to be attacked So say, for example, you're a bank and you're not adapting, and then Google decides to get it, or Amazon decides to get into banking. You're in trouble, because you can't respond to them if you've got these classic hierarchical systems. And then at the other time, you've got all the little mini fintech companies coming up and trying to eat you from the bottom up.
Yeah, but here's how hierarchy responds to this. It responds by trying to exert control over the external environment. So the banks that you're talking about that can't respond to the new fintech challenges will respond by pressuring government to create legislation, altering the external environment to their advantage and to the disadvantage of the fintechs.
Yes, absolutely. But the question is, can they keep up with the increased speed of technology in terms of regulating? And I think that's a very risky bet for them to take.
I think it's, by the way, I'm on the side of the adaptive guys, right? But I always like taking the authoritarian position just for laughs. And I think that there is, like, they could leverage the legacy. And the institutions at play, which are interlocking institutions, which are there basically providing this mutually supporting infrastructure to keep the situation as is, they don't necessarily want to see fintech. I mean, blockchain is a good example. I mean, what you say, I'll not get into blockchain now, we've got 5 minutes, but we can say it's a revolutionary paradigm in terms of how things might move. And it's revolutionary in the sense that it's certainly a threat to all of the old institutions, because it's created in such a way that it is fundamentally anti-institutional in many respects. Now, we can already see that countries and states and banks and legal organizations all kind of aligning their interests together to try and marginalize blockchain into a safe place where it can be controlled, typically by a bank. And I think that's the response of hierarchy to basically trying to restrict the dynamism of the external world. And
I absolutely agree. That's exactly what's going on. But you take the quote is that, you know, nothing has ever been as fast as what we're experiencing now. And yet what we're experiencing now is as slow as it's ever going to get, because it's going to continue to get faster and faster and faster because of the sheer speed of the digital realm. And so that battle between embedded institutional forces and then traditional ones versus this kind of agile, rapid quantum movement. I mean, I'd bet on the quantum, because that is actually reality. And the hierarchies, yes, the hierarchies, they exist within the complex adaptive systems, but they lose eventually. You know, the top of it, one of the things you will always see in every hierarchy is the ones at the top of the hierarchy get eaten and beaten and replaced.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no institution that's ever been completely immune. Well, we've seen that those things cycle through, and ultimately those paradigms get shifted, and the, you know, incumbents get thrown down, and the upstarts end up inheriting those positions. So it'd be very interesting to see where leadership goes in all of that. A couple of quick tips before we finish off, Richard. A bunch of people might listening to this and think, all right, I'm a leader and I want to be one of these future leaders. I want to be future fit for this environment. What do they need to do and learn in order to get to that position?
So first of all, if you want to be a leader, there's a gateway. The gateways into leadership is understanding the overall discipline. So I don't think you should align to any single model, but you really want to understand what the overall discipline is. So you know, do some research, just see what the gateway into the understanding the discipline of leadership for you is. But that's not as important as, well, what is the future of leadership going to look like? Well, it's going to look adaptive. I mean, almost certainly going to look adaptive. So you have to look at your life and you say, well, do I live an adaptive life? And for me, it means, are you doing very many things? Are you being transdisciplinary in your thinking? Because if you're not actually, okay, I'm going to look for stuff over here and then over here and over here, and I'm going to experience all of that, you're not setting yourself up to be a next generation leader. Just by following a leadership guru and reading one of their books and saying, oh, that's the model and I'll just do that, that is the opposite of what is required. You know, if you're going to read a leadership book, read 10 leadership books, and make a critical decision as to, okay, where's the value out of these books rather than just one, and then do all kinds of stuff beyond the field of leadership to make sure that you have this ability to bring creative adaptability into your life. If you're not doing that, you're not going to become a leader.
Yeah, really, really interesting. And I think we can all embrace that, Richard. You got to get involved in stuff outside of your domain, and you really have to just dive deep and learn stuff from that. That includes, by the way, having conversations with people outside of your bubble also. Like, one of the things that's very, very important, I think, is definitely maladaptive to future leadership is actually to lock yourself away and only speak to people of like mind. We have to get better at communicating with people that not only have adjacent views to us, but often adversarial views to us, in order to understand where they're coming from. Are we able to articulate their position? Do we, in good faith, understand what their position is? By all means, then oppose it and construct an argument against, but let's not go ahead and just dismiss and cut it off, because that means you're basically doing a narrowing, you know, and that's not going to be adaptive for the future.
Yeah, and I have a visceral reaction to like-minded. I hate the term. Like-spirited. I'm very happy with like-spirited, that we're going to go off and explore together and then always just assume good intent of the person you're talking to. In a like-spirited environment, assume good intent with the person you're talking to. If you can do both of those, I'm not looking for people who agree with me. I'm looking for people who are willing to wanting to explore in the same spiritual level. And I will always assume a good intent whenever they speak. I think you're halfway there.
You know what? I'm going to leave it with that amazing quote, Richard. Thank you so much for your conversation. As ever, it's a thrill speaking with you. I hope people do enjoy it. This is a different type of conversation, but I want to do more of these because I think we get much more from having kind of a one-to-one conversation and sometimes with the panel structure. So maybe this will be a future series for us to go and run in future. Okay, Dr. Richard Clayden, thank you so much for joining us on Brain Food Live on air. I hope you're well and good. I hope to get to Hong Kong at some point next 6 months, next 12 months. I will be there. I'll make sure I pop in.
We'll have a beer together.
Indeed. So take care, Richard.
You too.
What a super interesting guy. I tell you, follow Dr. Richard Clayden on LinkedIn. He is a person with an enormous amount of intellectual horsepower, and he talks a lot about the things we in recruiting and HR care about. Okay, folks, that's about it. Thanks for watching. We'll be back next week. We are talking to a bunch of Aussie recruiters. It's going to be the state of Australian agency recruiting in 2022. What does it look like? I only found out yesterday that actually Australia is like the fifth biggest recruiting market on the planet, apparently. I think it's got to do with all of those mining contractors and stuff. But anyway, it's a huge market. And I wonder what the rhythms are down under. I think they're probably very different from other places. So we've got some wonderful agency representatives who are going to bring data, insight, and observation. Tune in if you're interested in the Aussie market. It's going to be a good one. We'll see you next week, folks. Thanks for watching.